Good evening. Welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, May 9th, 2016. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Moscow Homeless Shelter Sojourners Alliance receives money to partially replace $100,000 in lost HUD annual grant. WSU Regents cuts undergraduate in-state tuition by 10%. Debate continues over legality of hiring process for new WSU President Kirk Schulz. Four states to work together for Wolverine protection. Donald Trump rallies in Spokane, and there's an anti-hate rally in Moscow. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Sojourners Alliance Director Steve Bonner says Wells Fargo Bank has provided a $7,500 grant to help keep the Moscow-based homeless shelter open on an emergency basis. Sojourners Alliance learned it will not receive the annual $100,000 Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development Transitional Housing Grant this year after keeping the shelter operating for 19 years, mostly with money from that grant program. Bonner spoke on KRFP's David Jerusalem show on Friday night.
Wells Fargo had $7,500 for us if I just filled out the grant application, so I did that. So what that does is keeping our doors open till about mid-July. And at that point, if I have no more money, I close then. And so we also have an off-site program that would be impacted by our closing, where we have 7 one-bedrooms, 2 two-bedrooms, and a 3-bedroom that we pay rent and utilities on for households who have an adult with a diagnosed disability and who are literally homeless. So at any given time, we can be providing housing between 30 and 50 people. In the year 2015, the calendar year, we provided support for 114 people came through our programs. And on the average, we're probably providing support for about 150 people a year.
That was Sojourners Alliance Director Steve Bonner. Bonner said last week the loss of the grant money was due to a change in HUD standards. He said there had been discussion that HUD was changing their priorities over the next couple of years. We've been planning for a transition on that time frame. We have plans to switch to the newly preferred HUD model. We need a chance to catch our breath. Sojourners Alliance opened a GoFundMe site to help fund the homeless shelter last Thursday. Latah County Commissioner Tom Lamar says he's working with representatives from the County Gritman Medical Center and other concerned parties to find a way to keep the homeless shelter open. Researchers from four state governments are working together to study the elusive wolverine in the Northern Rockies. Researchers from Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, and Washington want to know if there is prime habitat to reintroduce wolverines so their numbers can increase. There may be up to 300 wolverines remaining in the four states. Researchers plan to place cameras on trails where wolverines might go and use copper brushes to capture DNA samples from the animal's fur. Wolverines look like small bears with giant claws, but they don't hibernate, preferring to hunt in snowy mountain areas. Much of the tracking part of the research will take place in winter for that reason. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Carnivore and Fur Bearer Coordinator Bob Inman told the Great Falls Tribune, "We're identifying places that are good habitat that don't have wolverines, so we might be able to put them there to increase population size." The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is paying for the study. Debate continues over whether the hiring of new Washington State University President Kirk Schulz violated state open meeting laws. WSU Board of Regents member Ryan Durkin told the Lewiston Tribune the board sought legal advice on their controversial decision to keep the names of finalists secret. Durkin, who chaired the Board of Regents on March 25th when the selection of Schulz was announced, said, "We feel that we did follow the law. Unless you have confidentiality for applicants, you won't get the best applicants." During an open meeting March 25th, the board discussed and voted on the finalists using only the letters A, B, and C to refer to them. Board of Regents member Scott Carson told the Tribune the very competitive marketplace for university presidents means they must promise applicants anonymity. The Lewiston Tribune put in a public records request asking for documents which mention the names of the three finalists 3 days after the selection was announced and has received most of the documents, but the names are blacked out. Washington Coalition for Open Government President Toby Nixon said, "There's ample precedent that you can't do that. The law clearly requires all voting to be done in public in a way that members of the public can know who's being voted on and who voted which way. This voting in code, I think, is a clear violation of that." Back when he was a state legislator, Nixon was on the House Committee for State Government Operations and Accountability. Pacific Northwest Newspaper Association Secretary Rowland Thompson told the paper, "When the selection process becomes part of a public discussion, the option to keep finalists' names secret no longer applies." Thompson said, "Final action and deciding whether or not to hire someone has to be done in public. If somebody's going to get fired because they're a finalist for a job elsewhere, do you want them to work for you?" The Washington State University Board of Regents voted Friday to lower undergraduate in-state tuition by 10%, a move that's allowed by recent legislation passed in Olympia by the legislature. Starting in the fall, in-state undergraduates will pay $9,324 per year to attend WSU, down from $10,356 annually. Graduate students will pay the same tuition next year. In other board business Friday, the Regents approved a $192.7 million capital budget for the WSU system for the two-year period starting in 2017. The Daily News reports the capital budget approved includes $59 million for a new plant sciences building, $38 million for the second phase of the Allen Center Global Animal Health Building, $4.9 million for automation systems infrastructure and minor projects, $4.75 million for card key access infrastructure for the security building, and $3.5 million for the designing of the life and physical sciences building, all of those on the Pullman campus. The Regents also approved a $67 million operating budget. The operating budget includes salaries for faculty, staff, and graduate students at the new Elson Floyd College of Medicine, which WSU is starting in Spokane. The Whitman County Planning Commission has issued a notice of determination of non-significance on an application to open a retail cannabis store near the Idaho state line in the former Crossroads Nursery building on the Moscow-Pullman Highway. Recent rule changes by the Washington Liquor and Cannabis Board now allow up to two marijuana retail shops in unincorporated Whitman County, up from one, which was the limit after Initiative 502 passed in 2012. The limits were changed after the legislature voted last year to merge the state's recreational and medical marijuana systems. The County Planning Commission previously gave the go-ahead for a new pot shop in the former Wawawi Canyon Winery, also on the Moscow-Pullman Highway, but closer to Pullman. Latah County Sheriff Wayne Roush told the Lewiston Tribune, "It just makes it a little easier for the people who don't care if it's illegal or not. If you look at the parking lot of the shops in Pullman, 90% of the vehicles have Idaho plates." Speaking of marijuana users in Moscow, Roush said, "We have a generation here who thinks it's okay, and many millennials who don't care. The prevailing attitude has just gotten worse. It used to be that if you're into that, you were going to hide it, but not anymore. I don't expect there to be a big influx. On the other side, I don't think it will do any good for the community. All the hippies in Moscow want to smoke dope, and they'll find out that it has some far-reaching consequences." Washington State Auditor Troy Kelly, who recently endured a trial for possession of stolen money and money laundering that ended in a hung jury, has fired two top staffers and told another to stop working until he retires at the end of May. The Associated Press reports the two workers fired last week, Chief of Staff Doug Cochran and Communications Director Adam Wilson, say they got no explanation from Kelly as to why they were being fired. The 61-year-old Cochran, who worked in the auditor's office for 11 years, told the Associated Press, "He wanted my resignation and he got it. When we were done, I just, out of curiosity, asked why. All he said was, for the good of the organization." 38-year-old communications director Adam Wilson said Kelly asked for his resignation during a meeting with him last week. Wilson said, "He said, I think the executive and communications needs to work together. You can either resign effective immediately or I can fire you." After staff intervened, Kelly decided to allow Wilson to be on leave until the end of the month and take a personal day June 1st so he can get health care coverage until the end of June. Governor Jay Inslee wrote a letter to Kelly asking for an explanation. Inslee issued a statement saying, "During his extended absence due to his trial, the hardworking auditor's office staff worked diligently to maintain high standards, fulfill the mission of the auditor's office, and serve the people of the state of Washington." Numerous state politicians of both parties asked Kelly, a Democrat, to resign during his extended leave of absence as the case made its way through the courts. Federal prosecutors said Kelly kept $3 million from clients of his business that he wasn't entitled to during the decade before he was elected auditor. Late last month, a federal jury in Tacoma was hung on 14 counts and acquitted Kelly of one count of lying to the IRS. A study from the Property and Environmental Research Center, a think tank out of Bozeman, Montana, found states may receive greater benefits from owning and managing their own land rather than federal entities such as the U.S. Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management. According to the 2015 study, state-managed land returned financial benefits for every dollar spent, while federally managed lands under the guidance of the U.S. Forest Service or the BLM cost more to run than the revenue brought in. According to the Spokesman Review, the Washington State Association of Counties Policy States, WSAC, supports a systematic and factual review of the potential benefits and risks associated with the transfer of Federal Forest Service lands to Washington State or its counties. The issue has been a contested battle between those who think leaving the land under federal ownership is better than state ownership and those who think otherwise. Supporters of federal ownership say they fear states will sell the land to private entities, thereby cutting the public off from land access. Those proposing transferring ownership or management of federal lands to the states are excluding national parks and monuments from their proposals. Support and opposition fall into four categories: management costs, quality of management, loss of public access, and fears states will sell off public land to businesses or corporations. Supporters of potential land transfers say they are concerned about noxious weed control, citing cases where federal land managers are handcuffed by layers of internal regulations and little money, which makes timely responses to weed outbreaks difficult. Those opposed to land transfers are concerned about grazing leases because fluctuations in seasonal rainfall and variations in temperatures may create situations where a state or private land manager could get into trouble if he or she does not adjust the grazing plan to match conditions. The Property and Environment Research Center was founded 35 years ago and says it is the nation's first and largest institute dedicated to improving environmental quality through property rights and markets in an idea now called free market environmentalism. You're listening to KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump spoke to 4,000 people at the Spokane Convention Center Saturday. Trump called his political opponents dopes and said political correctness is killing our country. Although Democratic presidential candidates have easily won in Washington in recent decades, Trump said, referring to the November general election, "I guarantee that we're going to be back numerous times because we're going to win the state of Washington." About 50 protesters were on the Spokane Falls Boulevard sidewalk after the rally as exiting Trump supporters taunted them by chanting "Build that wall," to which the protesters chanted "Si se puede." One retired school teacher protesting Trump told the Spokesman Review she opposes Trump because she believes he is a racist. Debbie Scheibelt told the paper, "We're stepping back in time. This is why we had a civil rights movement." Judd Wilson of Moscow came to the Trump rally with his wife Melissa and five children. Wilson told the Spokesman Review he supports Trump because he plans to build a wall along the Mexican border. Wilson told the paper, "Racism and other terms like that are simply shut-up words designed to shut down political discourse." On Morning Mix today, we reported on a story from the Saturday edition of the Spokesman Review that the Trump campaign had declined to issue press credentials to Spokane's black newspaper, The Black Lens, for Saturday's rally. According to today's edition of the paper, the Trump campaign reversed that decision Saturday morning. Black Lens publisher Sandra Williams said although the Trump campaign gave no reason for the switch, she believes coverage of the denial may have had something to do with the last-minute change. A Trump aide told a reporter rejecting press credentials for the Black Lens was just a mix-up. The Spokesman Review reports the Spokane Action News, a local website, was denied access to Trump's Saturday morning rally. About 50 people attended an anti-hate rally Friday afternoon in Moscow's Friendship Square, organized by University of Idaho students. The students joined in with the Palouse Peace Coalition's weekly peace vigil. Those at the rally lined both sides of Main Street. Here's anti-hate rally organizer Jess McDermott, followed by other ralliers.
There's a focus or an example involving a University of Idaho student that you spoke up about that emulates the issue or talks about the issue.
Yeah, I felt like, well, unfortunately, the hate crime and murder that was committed against Steven Nielsen related exactly to what we were doing, which is protesting the spread of bigotry, xenophobia, and corporate greed that can lead to war. So it felt like a good time to pay respect to him with a moment of silence and then march.
This person, Steven Nielsen, a former University of Idaho student, graduate in 2011, lived in Nampa, and he was murdered last week. And the police haven't actually officially called it a hate crime yet, have they?
An article I read, I think they said, "Is this a hate crime?" question mark, which I thought was quite silly. It most clearly was from the information I read about how it occurred. It seemed they sought him out because he was gay. It could have been anyone, but it was him, anyone who identified as being gay.
Right, so. And he was severely beaten and later died at a remote place near Lowell Lake near Nampa, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Are there any other issues you want to talk about? There was a very general statement about it being an anti-hate, pro-love sort of demonstration, and of course the peace vigil is usually talking about the U.S. military and the interventions overseas. How do you see these two issues connecting, you know, domestic hate in the United States and the war machine?
Yeah, I see them as nearly the same thing. I think our intervention in countries like Afghanistan, Iraq, relates to the refugee crisis, relates to people not liking the U.S., which I could understand, or having a sort of hate for the U.S., and I think it breeds misunderstanding between everyday people. I guess that's how I see them connecting, especially with refugees. I know there's at least a few refugee signs and some anti-Trump signs, so instead of promoting xenophobia, bigotry, misunderstanding of these places on the other side of the globe that we know nothing about besides that we should fear them, or that they're terrorists. I think that's a big part of what this is. It all relates to capitalism and the breed of xenophobia, racism, sexism.
How do you see the refugee issue going? I know you've organized a lot on issues like the College of Southern Idaho Refugee Resettlement Center and so forth. For a while, there was a it seemed to be a large backlash not wanting any Syrian refugees. Has that died down, or is that just still simmering below the surface? I'm talking about, you know, basic politics in the United States.
I think it's just simmering under the surface. I know the group was trying to get, I think it was 1,200 signatures in order for them to completely shut down the CSI Refugee Center, and they only had got 300. They claimed they had more, but they lost the other signatures. But I think still 300 is enough people, especially in a smaller place like Idaho and then Twin Falls, that that's something to not take lightly.
I think, and that was a ballot initiative for the city of Twin Falls, right?
Yeah, written up by a group. I think they called themselves the Committee to Close the CSI Refugee Center.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll interview somebody else. Anything else you'd like to add?
It's like, with what's happening even globally, the rise of racism, sexism, I guess a backlash of the radical right, it's a good time for everyone to stand up and say something.
We're at the anti-hate protest in downtown Moscow on May 6th, and one sign from this UI student says, end systemic violence and inequality. Another said, there's no planet B, and the sign you're both holding says, we need change, and change starts in the streets when the people demand it. So you're talking about systemic violence and inequality. Do you feel that most of these issues that people are talking about today are all related, and what's the root? And you can go, either one can go first.
Ooh, that's
is it patriarchy? What is it?
That's a really good question. I wish I knew the answer as to what the one great root evil of it all was. I do think they are related. I think that injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. It has been said before, but it is still true. And I think so. If you're facing any one of these issues, you're going to address the other ones just in some of the facets. If you address women's issues, you're also going to end up addressing climate issues and economic and poverty issues as well. So,
what do you think? Is it greed?
Greed in a way. I think systemic violence is a good way to put it, because I think greed is kind of enveloped in that. I think there's a lot of corporatization of a lot of our systems, including our food systems, I think is one of the big ones, causing mass environmental destruction, indigenous peoples destruction, cultural destruction, you name it, and there's a corporation involved in it. And I think that's definitely a big piece of it that is not talked about quite as often as it should be.
Now, as protesters and possibly organizers, do you feel that it's better for yourself to focus on narrow parts of these broader issues, or to be embrace all these issues in your organizing as a whole?
I think a holistic approach is really important. I think, well, personally, I'm double majoring. I'm a biology and international studies student. I'll be graduating here in a week, so that's really exciting. But I also, I care about a lot of different issues. I'm vegan personally, as well as an environmental activist, and just all kinds of, I don't know, I think everything is kind of all wrapped up together.
Anything you want to say on that?
I think if you address any one of these, you're going to start talking about the greater issues, and what that looks like for different people is going to be different. So for some people, they're incredibly passionate about one particular issue. For some people, maybe LGBTQA issues, that's what they're passionate about and excited about, and if that's it, that's great. And if it's someone else who's just passionate about the general concept of peace, that's also wonderful. So I think using big general approaches like these to harness all of those people is really wonderful. And then letting people kind of go whether they will in their individual work, I think is important.
And you mentioned you're vegan, and that involves compassion for animals. You're also healthier because of that. Is that true?
Yeah, that's definitely true. But yeah, I would definitely say one of the main reasons that I'm vegan is just sustainability in general. Mm-hmm. I think that eating meat and eating cheese and dairy products takes a lot more land use than having a vegan diet. Eating lower on the food chain is just more sustainable in just about every way. And like I was talking about earlier, with the corporatization of our food systems, when you are eating these big corporate products, it contributes to a lot of destruction. Environmental destruction is one of the biggest ones, but there's also a lot of other issues enveloped in that that I think are really important, and being vegan is just kind of a way to address that in my daily life. My meals are really the only thing that I choose to do three times a day, every single day. You know, protests like this are really awesome. They kind of get a big group of people together, gets kind of a push, like a big energy push together. But being vegan, that's something that I choose to do every single day, three times a day. And I think there's not really anything you can do that beats that.
Do you want to give your name?
Courtney Stoker.
Okay. And do you want to give your name?
Lydia Hansen.
Those were some of the 50 people at an anti-hate rally in Moscow's Friendship Square on Friday. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. The weather, 50% chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms before 8 p.m., then isolated showers before midnight, mostly cloudy, low 39, northwest winds 10 to 15, becoming light after midnight with gusts up to 20. 20% chance of showers after noon tomorrow, otherwise mostly sunny, high 62, mostly clear Tuesday night and Wednesday, low 42, high 69, mostly cloudy, low 47 Wednesday night, and mostly clear conditions Thursday through Friday, highs Thursday 74, 77 on Friday, and a low 48 Thursday night. Currently at the Pullman Moscow Regional Airport, overcast, 54 degrees. Thanks for tuning in to the KRFP Evening Report. Coming up next, news and opinions from the West Side with Eat the Airwaves, followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio, and then our weekly call-in talk show, What's Left, coming up at 7:30 p.m. today. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. Remember, all editions of the KRFP Evening Report are archived on the KRFP website for streaming and download shortly after broadcast. I'm Lee Robartas. Have a good night. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman Community Radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.